This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
10 years ago, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, opened a lot of people's eyes to mass incarceration as a disaster, a failing of social justice. I'm joined today by Kai Wright, the host of WNYC's program, The United States of Anxiety. Now, Kai, you recently talked with the writer Reginald Dwayne Betts. How do you two guys know each other?
Well, we met while I was making a previous podcast called Caught, which was a look at the juvenile justice system through the lens of the kids in it. And Dwayne really walked us through that system together.
What was his story?
He, at age 16 in Maryland, he went with a group of friends to a mall. A guy came out of a mall, got in his car, and they put a gun to his temple and carjacked him. And it was, Dwayne tells a story that he decided to hold the gun because he was scared what would happen if somebody else had it. But he nonetheless put the gun to this guy's temple, and they got caught, and he was locked up for 9 years, many of it spent in solitary confinement.
What happened when he got out?
Well, he got out. He became a lawyer. That was itself a journey because he has a criminal conviction, and that was something that he had to overcome in order to pass the bar and be admitted in Connecticut. And he became an author, a very celebrated author. He wrote a memoir and a number of books of poetry. Most recently, he has published a new book called Felon. And so I sat down with Reginald Dwayne Betts. We started with him reading a poem called Essay on Reentry. And in this poem, he's telling his young son about his past and admitting that he'd been in prison.
Essay on Reentry. At 2 a.m., without enough spirit spilling into my liver to know to keep my mouth shut, my youngest learned of years I spent inside a box, a spell, a kind of incantation I was under. Not whiskey, but history. I robbed a man. This months before he would drop bucket after bucket on opposing players. The entire bedraggled bunch 5 and 6 and he leaping as if every layup erases something. That's how I saw it. My screaming, coaching, sweating presence recompense for the pen. My father has never seen me play ball as part of this. My oldest knew. Told of my crimes by a stranger. Tell me we aren't running towards failure is what I want to ask my sons. But it is 2 in the a.m. The oldest has gone off the dream in the comfort of his room. The youngest, despite him seeming more lucid than me, just reflects cartoons back from his eyes. So when he tells me, Daddy, it's okay, I know what's happening. It's some scraggling angel lost from his pack finding a way to fulfill his duty. Lending words to this kid who crawls into my arms wanting more than stories of my prison. The sleep that he fought while I held court at a bar. With men who knew that when the drinking was done, the drinking wouldn't make the stories we brought home any easier to tell.
Mm. Can you tell me about that conversation? What was this poem about?
Yeah, so it was wild, right? So I don't think I ever told anybody this story. A few months before, like the summertime before I got admitted to the bar, I was on the phone talking to somebody that was locked up, and my youngest son heard me say something or something, and he came down, and he was like, did you just say you was in jail? I was like, nah, I didn't just say that. I had absolutely just said that, right?
Because you had kept it from him.
I had kept it from him, but I guess I don't even think I had said that, but I said something that allowed him to infer that I had been locked up, right? And I finally get admitted to the bar. So after I get sworn in, you know, I turn around, I look at my mom. My wife is there, my sons are there, my grandmother's there, my uncle's there, my aunt is there. Like, the same people who were in court when I got sentenced were there. And I said, you know, the last time I was in a court like this, I was sentenced to 9 years in prison. My youngest son gets up, sits on his brother's lap, whispers something in his ear, and I'm like, oh, damn. I really just told him. So afterwards, you know, we had a party, but I stayed out late, though. I probably came in at, like, 2 a.m. And in this poem is what happens next.
Why had you been reluctant to tell him in the first place?
I mean, when do you introduce that kind of knowledge to somebody? My oldest, Makai, he once told me, Dad, you know, I'm not like my classmates. And I was thinking, shit, why not? I mean, I got a Yale law degree. You know, like, I don't understand what you mean. And I was like, your mama got an advanced degree, too. You know, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, we some, like, degree black folks, right? Yes. What do you mean you not like your classmates? And he's like, well, you know, they didn't have to learn when they were 5 that their dad went to jail. And I just hadn't, you know, and this is my oldest.
Yeah.
And I just hadn't thought about the fact that that was a, it sounds naive, really, to be like, I hadn't thought about the fact that that was a thing. Because I knew it was a thing when it happened. And he was crying, and I had to talk to him. And
yeah.
That's why I was reluctant. I thought I might be able to save my youngest son something. I don't know. You know, like, I might get pardoned or something. I mean, like I'm going to hold off until, like, something happens that makes it more palatable. You know, like, I mean, you don't ever want your children to feel bad for you, right? It's like, that ain't what you're in the world for. Like, you're not in the world to hurt for me. You know, I'm good. I'm supposed to help deal with whatever pain that you have to experience in this world. I'm supposed to protect you from all of that pain. I'm not supposed to, like, add to it in this way, you know?
Well, your record almost kept you from becoming a lawyer in Connecticut. I wonder if you can tell me about that. You got a letter from the Connecticut Bar Examining Committee that said you had to prove your, quote, good character before you could be admitted. What?
Yeah, that was, you know, it's wild, too, man. It's like I had to prove my character and fitness, and it's, that was one of the struggles, but also the struggle was just recognizing, again, I'm being reminded that, okay, how fast you run, you're not going to outpace the collateral consequences of a criminal conviction. And you will not run fast enough where that thing won't still be in your orbit. And that's what it reminded me of. It also reminded me of something else, made me aware of something else that, you know, I had to get these letters, right?
Yeah.
You get letters from friends, and it was a blessing to get all of these letters because it showed how many people supported me. But it was kind of tragic to feel like they had to put all of that on display for a body that should have admitted me on GP.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes me think about what does it mean if you, because I'm like gregarious, I'm like loud, you know, I'm like in the mix. But what if I was like an introvert, you know, like I'm like an introvert, extrovert. But what if I was like an introvert, and I didn't make these friendships, not because I didn't want to, but because I didn't know how to, you know, what would it have meant if I hadn't written 4 books? Because I could say I hadn't been hiding from prison. I mean, look, I just wrote all these books about it.
Right.
But what if I hadn't necessarily been hiding, but I just didn't want to make my life a long conversation about incarceration? I might not have gotten admitted. And that is...
You shouldn't have to be exceptional.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm exceptional, but right, you shouldn't have to be exceptional. You know, I'm decent. I got a nice jump shot, but.
It's hard to avoid a sense of hopelessness, I guess isn't really the word, but it feels a little hopeless in some of these poems. They're such heavy circumstances, and I know that's quite the opposite of how you feel about the work. How do we deal with the grim reality of this? Emotionally, thinking about the future and how we move forward?
Well, I would first, though, argue that maybe it's not as hopeless as like, even Essay on Reentry. You know, I'm there. You got a poem in which the speaker is a father who is grappling with telling his child that he was incarcerated, but the speaker is also a coach. The speaker is also figuring out ways to talk to his son about this really difficult thing. The speaker is actually thinking that it matters, and clearly he has some friends who he could talk to. You know, even the one about the for a bail denied. I mean, I still think a poem that centers a mother's pain and says, like, this mother is watching this, right? And she said, I'm going to be a voice of protest in this moment. It's actually also something hopeful, because when I got locked up, people weren't even having this conversation, right? And I know that when I got locked up, in the era of 16-year-old teenagers, 15-year-old kids, 17-year-old kids being called super predator, there was nobody. Like, Bernie Sanders could say whatever he want about what he felt about the crime bill, but I will say that nobody was standing up and saying, listen, this is my child. This is somebody in my community. And yes, we need to deal with violence and we need to address violence, but you will not talk about my children this way. Mm. And so I feel like, you know, these poems try to point those things out. And I think that's the hopefulness, right? I think that these poems are a series of occasions in which you got a man trying to figure out how to save himself. It's a collection of these men, you know, telling these stories. And they say that, you know, I am somebody here, and I deserve to be seen.
Can I ask you to close by reading one that I personally feel is unapologetically celebratory?
yeah, me too.
And it really speaks to my heart. It's called On Voting for Barack Obama and a Nat Turner T-shirt.
Yeah, I would say my dilemma with this whole book is, like, some of these things are deeply and intimately personal and about me, and some aren't. But this poem, like, brings me joy because it is me. And I remember the moment, and it also points out a bit about the randomness, is because I was able to vote in Maryland for President Obama only because I got off probation 2 years early. Mm. And there's a lot of people right now fighting across the country to get people to vote back. And I think this is hopeful because it says something about, you know, what voting means. But on voting for Barack Obama in a Nat Turner T-shirt, the ballot ain't never been a measure of forgiveness. In prison, people don't even talk about voting, about elections. Not really, not the dudes you remember, because wasn't nobody black running no way. But your freedom hit just in time to see this brother high-stepping with the burden, with the albatross, willing to confess that he knew people like you. And you are free. You are what they call out and off papers and living in a state where you're not disenfranchised. In prison, you listen to the ballot or the bullet and imagine that neither was for you, having failed with the pistol and expecting the ballot to be denied. But nah, you found free and in line noticed that this is not like the first time you and a woman you married got naked and sweated and moaned and funked up a room not belonging to either of you. That lady is with you now, and the kid is in your arms, and you are wearing a Nat Turner T-shirt as if to make a statement at the family reunion. Everyone around you is black, which is a thing you notice. And you know your first ballot will be cast for a man who has the swag that seems inherited. It's early, but there is no crust in your eyes. You wanted this moment like freedom. You cast a ballot for a black man in America while holding a black baby. Name a dream more American than that. Especially with your three felonies serving as beacons to alert anybody of your reckless ambition. That woman beside you is the kind of thing fools don't even dream about in prison. And she lets you hold your boy while voting, as if the voting makes you and him more free. Sometimes it's just luck. Just having moved to the right state after the cell door stopped clanking behind you. The son in the arms of the man was mine, and the arms of the man belonged to me. And I wore that Nat Turner T-shirt like a fucking flag, brown against my brown skin.
Dwayne, thank you for this collection and for your work.
Thank you. This was, thank you, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's cool.